While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Hey, very good afternoon, Namibia, and to our faithful listeners joining us across the region and around the world. Welcome to Eagle FM. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and you are currently tuned into On the Reading News Analysis this Thursday, the 21st of May, 2026. Now, as the week progresses, we welcome you to another edition of the program, your trusted platform for informed discussion, critical thinking, and deeper insight into the stories shaping Namibia today. Now, this afternoon, we'll continue to unpack the developments influencing the country's economic, political, and social landscape, with national attention focused on governance, on innovation, infrastructure development, entrepreneurship, public accountability, and the everyday realities reflecting or affecting communities across Namibia. Now, today's program reflects on some of the major conversations currently shaping public discourse, that is including housing and land delivery, digital transformation, youth empowerment, sustainable development, economic diversification, public sector reform, and Namibia's growing ambitions within emerging industries. Now, we'll examine the importance of practical implementation in national development, ask whether policy discussions, conferences, and strategic frameworks are translating into measurable outcomes for ordinary citizens. Now, from housing delivery and service provision to public sector efficiency and technological advancement, many Namibians continue to question how quickly meaningful change is reaching communities on the ground, or can reach communities on the ground. Now, at the same time, we reflect on the opportunities and the pressures facing the country. Today, we also revisit important discussions emerging. And then, now, remember, you can listen via, listen to Eagle FM via Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app so you can stay connected through our digital platforms and WhatsApp channel for updates as well. Now, let's get right into these discussions and bring you what's on the table and get ready also to engage with us on that. An information sharing session on community supervision in Namibia took place today on Thursday at the Government Information Sharing Center. The session has brought together, bringing renewed attention to the role of correctional services, rehabilitation, and community-based justice systems within the country's criminal justice framework. Now, there's been, of course, a growing outrage from the public, especially when they see those offenders that have been released into the community, perhaps even being interviewed on radio every now and then for a good cause, and offering their advice and their counsel to the community and the young people out there to stay away from crime. There's quite been an outrage from the community and for many people, especially on social media, speaking about how sometimes it doesn't look nice or portray a nice picture to their family. Now, the session have brought together stakeholders from the justice system, particularly being the Deputy Commissioner Frida Nsewe, who is the head of community supervision at Namibia Correctional Services, as well as Senior Superintendent Gregor Sehole, who is a community supervision at the nation, at the Namibia Correctional Services. Now, the aim was to discuss the effectiveness, the challenges, and the future direction of community supervision programs in Namibia. Community supervision refers to correctional and rehabilitation measures that allow certain offenders to serve sentences or undergo monitoring within communities, under regulated conditions rather than through full-time incarceration. And these measures may include probation, parole supervision, community service orders, reintegration programs, behavioral monitoring, rehabilitation support initiatives. And the discussions came at a time where many countries, including Namibia, are increasingly exploring alternatives to overcrowded correctional facilities while balancing public safety, accountability, and offender rehabilitation. Participants at the session, we expected to examine how community supervision can contribute to actually thoroughly reduce reduce repeat offending, and also for them to, and discussions on better social integration with stronger family and community support systems. Now, these programs also reflect broader conversations around restorative justice and the importance of creating correctional systems that focus not only on punishment, but also on rehabilitation, on behavioral change and reintegration into the society, even though some people may have a different overview regarding that. That's because further discussed the role communities themselves can play in supporting rehabilitation processes and helping former offenders to transition back into the productive social and economic participation. Another important issue receiving attention is the social stigma often faced by individuals. Reintegration into communities after serving sentences. Analysts say long-term rehabilitation efforts are frequently undermined when former offenders struggle to access employment, housing, education, or social acceptance. Now, the information sharing session also highlights the increasing importance of evidence-based approaches in criminal justice reform, particularly as governments seek more sustainable and humane correctional systems. Now, for Namibia, discussions around community supervision are linked to wider national objectives relating to public safety, to human rights, to social stability, and institutional reform within the justice sector. Now, observers say strengthening rehabilitation and reintegration systems could contribute not only to reducing overcrowdedness, but also to improving long-term community safety and social cohesion. And the session concluded with recommendations aimed at improving cooperation between correctional services and communities and other stakeholders that are involved in offender rehabilitation and community supervision programs across Namibia. Now, the two guests that were at the Government Information Sharing Center that went to share their ideas and, of course, share practical knowledge on ground on how the Namibia Correctional Services plays its part in rehabilitation or into integration within the society, are Deputy Commissioner Frida Nsewe and Senior Superintendent Gregory Sekole. Let's take a listen to that conversation they had.
So the Correctional Service Act, mm-hmm. Act 9 of 2012, makes provision for the conditional release of offenders after they have served a period of their sentence in a correctional service, mm-hmm. to continue serving the remainder of their sentences into the community or society.
Right.
So community supervision then entails the supervision of these offenders after they have been released from the correctional facilities. Mm-hmm. From the correctional facilities, mm-hmm. to serve the remainder of their sentences in the community. Mm-hmm. So the provision is made for offenders who are conditionally released on parole, mm-hmm. full parole, mm-hmm. or remission of sentence, mm-hmm. after they have been found then fit to be released. So full parole entails it's the conditional release, like I've indicated, mm-hmm. it's a conditional release,
okay.
meaning it's a release of an offender, mm-hmm. with certain conditions attached to their release,
right.
which they will have then to abide to during the time that they are in the community. So at the period, at a certain period, when the offender is assessed and is found suitable, as per the Correctional Service Act, then the offender is assessed and released on full parole. So the release of offenders on full parole is also dependent on the type of the offences they have committed, and the whether they're scheduled or non-scheduled, or whether it's the severity of the offences.
The community supervision officers are correctional officers that have been appointed in the correctional service and that received a specialized training in order for them to be working with these inmates or offenders that have been released. So these correctional officers are assigned specifically these duties of supervising these inmates, offenders. So the community supervision officers at present are based at our correctional facilities. We have 14 correctional facilities at present. And these officers at the facilities conduct these sessions when the offenders are being released, conduct the sessions to orient them on community supervision and what is expected of them. And while they're in the community, these offenders then, as per their supervision levels, would come and report to these officers. So how do they monitor these offenders? They monitor them by conducting these face-to-face sessions with them, telephonic phone calls, and providing guidance to them as to what is expected of them, the conditions under which they are released. And they are also there to be a support for these offenders. With whatever reintegration struggles they might be having or facing, helping them to receive guidance as to which offices they might go to with certain needs, because they are released back into the community, but at times the support in the community
lacks.
It lacks, and it's difficult for them to know perhaps where to go, what to do. So these officers are there to be that sort of support for them as well. And they monitor them by doing home visits as well to ensure that the environment where these offenders are living is safe, is conducive, to intervene when there are certain challenges that they have, maybe at home, with family.
So community supervision is pretty much part of the offender risk management correctional strategy. So the offender risk correctional management strategy is a strategy that we use in the correctional service that inform us in how we assess, how we manage, and in terms of what type of programs do we provide to the offenders when they are incarcerated. So community supervision then happens at the back end of this strategy, at the time when the offenders are nearing their conditional release. So at the time when the offender is about to be released, then the offenders are assessed and then they are placed on community supervision on the day when they are released from the correctional facilities.
I think as we have also alluded to in part of the questions, is that these offenders are released, but there's still so much difficulty transitioning into the community. So this structured release helps to be able to address certain outstanding risks and needs that these offenders could still be presented with, that they might still have. So releasing them in this structured manner still provides sort of a support for them. That they are not alone out there, and they can still have some form of accountability as to how they behave in the community, knowing that there are consequences to their actions. So having this supervision of these offenders also assists in us monitoring and picking up beforehand in case they might be at risk of reoffending, and trying to intervene so that this person can be more rehabilitated or reintegrated and thus reduce their risk of future offending.
Okay.
after they've gone through the process of assessment for placement on community supervision. So we also develop an action plan for them in terms of the goals that we'd like them to work towards with their community supervision officers to assist them to fully reintegrate into the society. So like we've indicated that the Namibian Correctional Service then looks at addressing these outstanding needs that they have not been taken care of while and, or during the time the offender were in the correctional facilities. So part of these goals are also then to for family support or to reconnect with families. And yeah, so the community supervision officers then have sessions with the family or as the specific offender with their family members, and then also be referring the offenders to stakeholders or our partners such as the social workers also in the community, because remember these offenders are in the community.
Right.
So they need to become part of their community.
Where they came
where they came from.
Became offenders.
Where they be before they became offenders. So we refer then also to the social workers or for other goals we refer to our stakeholders or where we see fit that this intervention can be best provided by the specific organization or agency for them also to be able then to assist the offenders.
All right. Mr. Sichogele, do you have something to add on to this?
Yeah, I'd say that it's somehow on a needs basis that we would step in most of the time. Because at the time of release, we try to ascertain the offender's release address. And so at that point, we would be able also to pick up that the family perhaps does not want to receive the offender.
There is resistance.
Yeah, there is resistance. And we would also try to conduct some sessions or talk to the family in order to help them understand and to accept this offender back. But additionally, throughout their incarceration as well, offenders are able to contact their families.
Right.
So they do have contact, and we also have a program, Restorative Justice, that we also try to use at times for offenders to be able to repair these relationships.
Right.
Yeah, and in the same vein that if this is a concern that has also been identified during incarceration, it, like Commissioner said, becomes part of their reintegration plan, which is also worked towards throughout incarceration, and then we can also pick it up from there once they are released in the community.
Right.
Okay, so when the offenders are released, they are assessed to determine their supervision levels.
Right.
So the supervision levels varies from offender to offender based on the assessment. So you will find some of the offenders who will be reporting under the low supervision levels. So these are the offenders who will mostly report after a 3-month period.
Okay.
So then we also have moderate supervision level. So these will be then the offenders will be reporting once a month for supervision level. And then we have the rather the more high supervision level, which is intensive for offenders who upon release, what we assess, we have find they still need time or they still possess high risk to still maybe get engaged in untowards activities that can risk their release condition. So they then report after every 2 weeks.
Okay.
So the offenders report to the correctional facilities.
Right.
Like, the nearest correctional facility to their release addresses. But as you have asked Helene, that we know our geographical setup in Namibia, and it, because we do not have correctional facilities
everywhere,
in all the towns or in most of our regions. So we have an agreement with the Namibian police, our sister force, where our offenders then that cannot reach the correctional facilities that can then utilize different police stations nearest to their areas of release to report for their supervision.
Okay, now let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Just a little bit of highlight for you on what the correctional service or Namibia's correctional services have to say about rehabilitation and, yeah, as offenders and not trying to or have them repeat offenders. Now let's pause here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Please do stay tuned. Should you want to partake in the news bulletin, also stay around or stick around. More interesting news coming your way.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the R.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva tere uliko ni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa vera hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu omafilane Eagle FM VI.
Welcome back. Now in other news, the Bank of Namibia today is hosting a housing research seminar under the theme Addressing Housing and Land Constraints. What will move the needle? The seminar forms part of the Central Bank's ongoing research and policy engagement series aimed at simulating national dialogue on some of Namibia's most pressing socio-economic challenges, particularly housing affordability, land access, and urban development. The discussion comes at a time when housing and service land shortages continue to place increasing pressure on households, local authorities, and the broader economy, especially in rapidly growing urban centers such as Windhoek, Vaalspruit, Swakopmund, and Oshakati. The seminar brings together policymakers, economists, researchers, local authorities, financial institutions, urban planners, developers, land experts, and the private sector stakeholders to examine practical and sustainable solutions to Namibia's housing and land challenges, and finally, hopefully, get a tangible conclusion, and that this research work will be used as a backbone to not only catalyze conversations, but rather to get into action. Now, central discussions are expected to focus on the structural barriers that continue to affect housing delivery and affordability in Namibia. And I believe it was the Right Honorable Prime Minister, Eliang Raire, who at the particular event at the Bank of Namibia told them to do something about Namibia's affordability with rent. It was at the Bank of Namibia, but it was at an event where he spoke about that, which is very worth applauding, that even the Bank of Namibia is sitting down to have such discussions, because being the central bank, other banks can now follow suit and, yeah, can do something about it. Because, of course, a lot of people, a lot of Namibians are crying and emotionally drained that they are able to take a mortgage for a car. They'll be able to buy a car through the bank, and yet buying a house through the bank is significantly expensive and difficult for them. Now, of course, that's because housing remains one of Namibia's most significant developmental concerns, with growing demand for affordable homes and service land continuing to outpace supply. And analysts have repeatedly warned that limited access to affordable housing not only affects household welfare, but also constrains labor mobility, productivity, and long-term economic inclusion. Now, the Bank of Namibia's involvement in the discussions, reflects the increasing recognition that housing is not only a social issue, but also an important economic and financial sector concern. And affordable housing development has direct implications for economic growth, for job creation, for infrastructure investment, for financial sector stability, urban productivity, household wealth creation, and poverty reduction. In a situation where many Namibians, for some, even 50% of their salary goes into rent alone. The seminar is also expected to explore the role of public-private partnership, innovative financial mechanisms, and policy reform in accelerating land delivery and affordable housing development. Now, discussions may further examine how Namibia can strengthen collaboration between government, municipalities, financial institutions, developers, and communities to unlock sustainable urban development. And another important issue likely to receive attention is the growth of informal settlements, which continue to expand as urban migration increases yearly, and many low and middle income households struggle to access affordable land and housing opportunities. Even proper sanitation or proper living conditions with sanitation. A lot of Namibians, of course, live within the capital city and have to go and fetch water from the tap, like as if they are living in rural areas. Now, the seminar forms part of broader national conversations, but let's get right into that. Let's take a listen to the speakers that are speaking at the seminar. And Bo Mena Luvindaur spoke on tracking progress, uncovering gaps, and identifying scalable solutions regarding this. But let's hear from the Governor of the Bank of Namibia, Mr. Ebson Wanguta.
Important research seminar hosted under the theme Housing in Namibia, Tracking Progress, Uncovering Gaps, and Identifying Scalable Solutions. As highlighted during the curtain raiser held alongside the launch of the 2025 annual report at the end of March, the Bank Richest Seminars series is focused on areas of national policy priority, particularly those linked to leverage the bank research and analytical capabilities to strengthen collaboration with stakeholders across sectors and deepen partnership with academic institutions in order to generate evidence-based insights and practical solutions to critical national challenges. It is my distinct honor to officially open this important engagement. Today, we bring together important players in the housing market, including policymakers, regulators, researchers, financial institutions, practitioners, and other stakeholders to discuss one of the most pressing issues facing our country. Housing remains a central pillar of economic development, social stability, and inclusive growth. Yet, it continues to present significant challenges that require coordinated and evidence-based solution beyond its social importance. Adequate housing must also be recognized as strategic economic infrastructure that supports productivity, that supports also labor mobility, household financial resilience, urban efficiency, and long-term inclusive growth. No economy can industrialize effectively where access to housing remains disconnected from economic opportunity. Housing remains very central to Namibia's development agenda, and it is also identified under NDP 6 as a key pillar for improving quality of life and ensuring decent living condition for all Namibians. In this regard, NDP 6 targets the construction of about 55,000 houses from a baseline of 12,598, while also seeking to reduce the proportion of household living in informal settlement from around 28% to half of that, which is around 14% nationwide. Yet the scale and urgency of the challenge continue to intensify. The latest census statistics indicate that Namibia is now 53% urbanized, with urban migration continuing at a rapid pace. At the same time, the latest FNB housing index shows that the average house price in Windhoek has surpassed 1.4 million, placing formal home ownership increasingly beyond the reach of many Namibians, particularly those who are in the low and middle income household. This growing affordability gap is further compounded by limited access to service land, rising construction costs, infrastructure constraint, and persistent structural bottlenecks in housing supply. If urbanizations continue to outpace infrastructure delivery, service land provision, and integrated spatial planning, Namibia as a country risk a future marked by expanding informal settlement, widening inequality, increased pressure on public services, and rising social and economic vulnerability. The housing challenge is therefore not simply a question of a shelter. It sits at the intersection of urban planning. It is crucial for infrastructure financing, economic inclusion, productivity, as well as long-term national sustainability. These housing challenges are unfolding against an increasingly uncertain and complex global developments. Heightened geopolitical tension, persistent supply chain disruption, and elevated energy prices continue to place upward pressure on the cost of construction materials, on the cost of transport, on financing, as well as broader infrastructure development. For Namibia, these external shocks are not abstract global developments. They translate directly into rising housing costs, reduced affordability, and growing constraint on both housing supply and household access to finance. At the same time, the cost of inaction continue to rise. Persistent housing shortages and expanding informality have far-reaching implications that extend well beyond the housing sector itself. They place pressure on urban infrastructure and municipal services. They deepen household vulnerability. They weaken social cohesion and constrain economic participation and productivity. If left unresolved, this pressure risks undermining broader national development objectives and long-term sustainability and resilience and inclusivity of Namibia's urban growth trajectory. Ladies and gentlemen, our country now stands at the threshold of becoming an oil and gas producing nation. This transition, as it is coming, it presents an opportunities for economic expansion, for further investment, for employment creation, and infrastructure development. However, it will also place an additional pressure on housing demand. It will also place pressure on the servicing land affordability or availability and urban infrastructure, particularly in key economic and coastal centers expected to experience increased industrial and population growth as a result of these new developments. Without us and without proactive planning, coordinated spatial development, and deliberate policy alignment between different institutions in our country, these pressures risk further widening existing inequalities in access to affordable housing as well as essential services, while intensifying pressure on already constrained urban systems. The strong turnout and diversity of participants gathered here today is both very encouraging and also reflective of the urgency and the national importance of the housing question in our country. This seminar provides an important platform to take stock of the progress thus far, the progress that we have achieved so far, and then continue to interrogate persistent gaps and constraints and collectively as well explore the most practical, the most scalable and sustainable solution that can meaningfully shift the trajectory of housing delivery in Namibia. Today's discussion, therefore, provides an opportunity to deepen our understanding of the structural drivers shaping housing supply, affordability, and urban development in our country, to identify the constraints limiting progress, and to explore practical intervention capable of delivering impact at scale. The Bank of Namibia, as an institution, we remain very committed to supporting informed dialogue, evidence-based policy making, and strengthen policy coordination between our various players in a ways that safeguard our core mandate of price and financial stability, while at the same time advancing sustainable, inclusive, and resilient economic development. Ladies and gentlemen, with these few remarks, we really look forward to a productive and a very insightful engagement. And thank you in advance for your active participation. With this, we declare this seminar open.
And I was going to listen to one of the presenters presenting what's really out there in within Namibia and what practical steps can really be done to get to a solution?
The progress that we have achieved so far. Posium at that time revealed in clear terms the structural fault lines running through Namibia's housing market. One of the main findings was that more than 70% of Namibians have no access to credit facilities offered by the financial services sector, and consequently could not afford to buy urban land or housing. Among other additional findings, the symposium also identified the behavior of the market itself as part of the problem at the time. Today, we are here to ask ourselves two critical questions. Where do we stand today? And where do we go from here? The scale and complexity of Namibia's housing challenges require more than isolated interventions. It requires institutional coordination, policy alignment, innovation, and a shared national commitment. This platform provides us an opportunity to not only speak openly about challenges we face, but also to propose practical and sustainable solutions that are in the interest of the Namibian people. We are all aware of the imbalances between demand and supply of housing in the country. We are aware that it's underpinned by long-standing structural constraints, including limitation on land delivery, land servicing, and affordability, among others. Our housing challenges are also exacerbated by rapid urbanization driven by rural to urban migration alongside sustained population growth. These trends place increasing pressure on urban infrastructure and housing delivery systems. Having said that, it's worthy mentioning that government has not stood idle. Several reforms and interventions have been introduced over the years, and these have made a difference. However, we also acknowledge with realism and honesty that much is still required, considering the scale of the problem, particularly the deficit in supply. Yet the scale of the challenges continue to outpace our collective efforts. That is the uncomfortable reality we must confront honestly. As I've said, let me repeat what the governor have said. During NDP5, 25,111 plots were serviced, and 50,000 plots are to be serviced during NDP6 period. 12,598 houses were built for low and ultra low income groups, while 55,000 are planned to be built during NDP6. The aim is to reduce households living in informal settlement from 28% to 14% by 2030. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, today we are not here simply to receive information and return to our offices. We are to participate and constructively in crafting responses that are practical and sustainable. The 2011 symposium gave us the diagnosis. The years that follow gave us experience of what works, what does not, and what we must do differently. The responsibility before us now is to convert the experience into practical, sustainable, and measurable progress for the Namibian people. Ladies and gentlemen, as I close, I urge you to make the most of this seminar. Ultimately, the success of this engagement will not be measured by the quality of presentations or the number of recommendations we produce. It will be measured by whether, over time, fewer Namibians are forced to live
without dignity, security, and hope. Because somewhere tonight or today, in an informal settlement, in an overcrowded shack, or in an unfinished structure, there is a family still waiting for the promise of decent shelter and a place to call home to become a reality. I thank you.
And. A round of applause.
Close to 50%. You know, because we are 40-something.
Issue that people were literally
adequately. So I would simply say where we are at, if I to go back to the question, where we are at and the targets that we have, we are far off. But it's not to say it's not achievable. From where we sit, that particular target is achievable. We just needed to realign. You know, what we push at local authorities is just to say that the funding formula should be set. You know, because if you leave it to feelings, for example, or seasonal changes, this year you can get this amount, the following year you get the other amount. Population growth is steady. You know, if we are growing at 4%, we are growing at 4%. It's not changing. You know, so then if, for example, previous year I was given, say, 100 million, the following year I'm given a 20 million, you already know that the impact in the long term is massive. In short, we are short of the target, but it's attainable. It can be corrected. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Thomas, just to weigh in exactly in the delivery chain, from the point of view of NHE, where are you experiencing much of the challenge?
Thank you, Abigail. Okay, there we go. Good morning, everyone. I think this is a very important topic, and specifically where we are now at land servicing. I think it's important to understand that you can't build a house in the air. So if we don't look at the aspect of land servicing, then you are not looking at housing. And seeing the bottlenecks that were just mentioned now by my learned colleague from the city, who are actually holding the mandate for government for land servicing, it's clear that institutions like NHE, we are falling in the value chain, the land release in terms of ready land for housing construction is hampered. Now, we fall in the same situation, of course, and for NHE specifically, of course, we have been criticized to say, no, NHE, your houses are expensive, but it's boiling down to the point that it's the land cost for servicing that impacts that. So whenever an institution that's at the end of the value chain is expected to fork that amount or that cost, that means that cost will be passed to the end user. So if we are speaking of solutions and if we are speaking of where we are today, we need to do headways with regard to what do you do with land servicing. So firstly, the resources must start at the beginning of the value chain and not the end. So right now, we're sitting with a huge problem in the country where the services in most, let's say countrywide, the services are outdated, or let's say they have reached their peak. The sewer lines are bursting. Now, that means we can't increase housing without fixing and also increasing those services that are currently existing. So that means already we are having a challenge beyond the challenge. So we are talking of housing at the end, but we are going to be in a situation where we have money for housing, but we can't put it on the ground because the local authorities will say, no, but the sewer capacity that we have will not hold the affluent that will come from that. So this land servicing section where we are, I really just want to emphasize to say, it's one that we really need to look at. It's one that is the key to solving housing. And perhaps this is where government should direct their resources first. And then secondly, just to couple to that, solutions, colleagues, solutions are there, but it's two things. Either you put up a strict, sort of directive, then money will be channeled. That's strict. And coupled to setting goals like what this Mr. Manda said. Secondly, you literally get a helping hand and you work with Triple P's. You need to, or we need to bring in the private sector, couple together, prepare, put together proper Triple P frameworks, let these objectives fund themselves. So these are the two key sort of solutions that I'm looking at. I think we are not exhausting the Triple P's enough, or we are not really doing it at scale. Secondly, when we set plans and goals, we're not supporting it with the resources strictly. That's really my contribution to that. Thank you.
Helvet, you want to weigh in?
Thank you. No, I do agree with my two colleagues that the issue of housing, solving housing for me, it's firstly a public policy issue, primarily. I think we need to start the discussion at one, having a proper definition in terms of what should be the role of government in resolving the housing problem. I think when we started off, if you look at the earlier policies, the focus was, as my colleagues have said, it was on the delivering housing units. You basically wanted to go cut a ribbon at the door of a house. But I think if we look at how the scale of the problem has worsened and also the complexity of that problem has worsened, I think that method of delivery is just something that's not going to work. If we follow that, it's going to, I don't even want to say it's going to take us very many years to solve the problem. We might never solve the problem if we continue with that approach. So the right thing to do, I think, is what has been defined now in the 2023 housing policy, that you need basically government to focus on supporting, Mr. Shilongo had said at the beginning, in terms of how do we capacitate the local authorities with the resources that they need, and also the technical capacity that's needed for us to basically expedite the delivery of services, so that we ensure that there's a secure land tenure, and that the private sector is then able to run with the ball from there on. But I think the one thing that I wanted to comment on, it doesn't end up being affordable anymore. So for me, it's very, very critical that government resources are channeled into land servicing and also financing of bulk infrastructures in local authorities, so that then the private sector can take it on from there. If you
Okay, let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with News Beyond the Borders of Namibia, and then we'll get into this conversation more properly tomorrow and try and digest it and break it down and understand what exactly it is that was being spoken there. For now, let's pause right here and make room for a scheduled commercial break. Stay tuned.
Why pay more when you can pay less at USave stores? Enjoy nutritious and delicious meals for the whole family. 2 kilograms of real good frozen mixed chicken portions for only $99.99. 5 kilograms of rice cane, just $92.99. Save $7. 500 grams of U-brand 40% fat spread, just $14.99. 500 grams of Wright brand spaghetti, just $9.99. USave, where good food costs less.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have the capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about
it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere uliko ni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijemo ili nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora isatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ilia konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back, and now let's get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. Starting off in South Africa, moving over to continental news, thereafter international news. Of course, let's start off in South Africa regarding their weather, and they're bringing their weather into focus, therefore understanding South Africa's extreme weather conditions.
Today, we still take a closer look at South Africa's volatile and increasingly unpredictable weather conditions following the devastating storms, the floods, the severe cold fronts that swept through parts of the Eastern Cape, the Western Cape, the Northern Cape and the Northwest over the past 2 weeks. We now cross back to Ayanda Nyati at the South African Weather Service in Centurion in Pretoria. Ayanda, it's safe to assume that at this particular point, you're well versed on how weather broadcasting, is carried out, especially where you are.
Yeah, I mean, if things don't work out for me on the news desks in Pretoria, I might just hop onto the weather desk, given how much I've learned over the past couple of hours whilst we're here. We're still stationed for you at the Irene Weather Office, where we've really taken in a lot of the infrastructure surrounding the meteorological work that is involved in the South African Weather Service. And let me tell you, so much science is involved in the process itself. And what we're about to show you really attests to that. It's a upper air monitoring process, and I'll allow our experts to do more of the talking, but come on in with us as we take you through what this process is about. It essentially entails measuring the atmosphere, the temperature, and the likes, and is crucially important for aviation. So whenever you, for example, are in a flight and you're being told about what the temperature is like, the turbulence, for example, where the clouds are at, this is the process that informs all of that. And a good friend of ours since we've been here is Rudzani Malala, once again, the head of disaster risk reduction here at the South African Weather Service. Good to see you again. So we've really taken you away from your job, but it's fine because this is important work. Help us place where we are. Already you can hear the acoustics are different. It's going to get a bit loud later on when the process gets underway. But please describe for us what we're about to see, because there's important science that takes place here.
Thank you once again, Ayanda. Yes, here we are now in a balloon room. Okay, basically the process here is to monitor what is happening in the atmosphere. So we call it upper air monitoring. So what happens is we have got a balloon And we also have got an instrument that measures all the parameters that we do, same as the automatic weather station. So here in this room, I will take you through to see what is happening. To fill up a balloon, we need a gas, and a gas that is light. In this case, if for those who did chemistry, they know the lighter gas is hydrogen or helium. So here we do produce hydrogen gas. So to produce this hydrogen gas, we need an equipment. I'll show you an equipment that does generate this gas. It's called a hydrogen generator. So what you're seeing here is just like a washing machine type, but this equipment is very, very important and quite expensive as well. We're talking close to 5 million rand just to get this machine.
Wow.
So what it does is we use water as hydrogen gas. It's a combination of hydrogen and oxygen, H2O. So what we do is we get water, normal water that we have. I'll show you another equipment here. This one is where we purify that water, because we need pure water so that we are able to separate the hydrogen and oxygen so that we can get hydrogen. So in this equipment, water comes, normal water that we use or that we get from the tap, then is purified to remove all other chemicals. And once purified, it comes to this machine. Then the hydrogen generator machine separates that. And the gas that is generated here or that is produced, then it goes into the storage tank. You'll see a big tank here. And this tank is where we store this gas, hydrogen gas. As you know, that hydrogen gas is quite a flammable gas. It needs to be handled with care. Like any other gas that we use for cooking at home and all that, it must be handled with care because it's flammable. So you will see we monitor the pressure there. When it's full, it's automated. The process is all automated.
Or else it could explode, right?
Yes, yes, it can explode. So when it's full, it will stop, cut off, and then continue again when it's released. But then from the tank will come, and you will see the entire process of filling up the balloon. It's quite a huge balloon. In grams, we measure it, it's about 350 grams. When it's filled, you'll see it's quite a big balloon.
Yeah.
And then with the equipment that is attached to it, which monitors everything. Let me show you quickly.
And I know, of course, perhaps we can allow Bonga, who's also here, to go ahead and fill the balloon. Before we speak about the equipment, there it is. Before it's inflated, the balloon is on the table there. And, of course, once it's inflated, it's going to be much bigger than it is. But actually, the point of interest is this piece of equipment. That's where all the measurements are going to come from.
Yes. You look at this, small as it is. Yeah. Once it goes up there, it will be measuring from here. You can see, very small as it is, that's the beauty of technology. It's able to do all that the automatic weather station does. It will measure the temperature, the pressure. It will tell you at which level it is, the humidity, and all those parameters that you are looking for. The wind direction, wind speed, all is measured from here. So you can see at what level the temperature, pressure, and all these things as we go up. So it will go up in the atmosphere. At times, it depends on the conditions of the atmosphere. It can go as high as 20 kilometers. Sometimes it can burst even earlier before it reaches there because of the conditions up there in the atmosphere. But what is important, it helps us to monitor the atmospheric condition throughout. So we can tell at 5 kilometers, the temperature, the wind, all these parameters are like this. So as it goes, it sends back the signals or that information. That data is real time.
Sure. Yeah, and just for perspective, by the way, typically an aeroplane will be around 10 kilometers into the sky. So this is going to double that distance from the surface of the earth all the way into the atmosphere. Now, Mr. Malala, I know time is important, so perhaps let's invite Bonga to go ahead and start inflating this balloon. I'm told it's quite a noisy process, so we'll try to keep a bit of a distance away from it. If you can come towards me, Mr. Malala, so we can speak more about this process while Bonga from the South African Weather Service goes ahead to inflate this balloon with the hydrogen that we spoke about. You have told us that this process actually takes place not only in South Africa, but in fact around the world around the same time.
Yes, this is a global process of monitoring the atmosphere under the World Meteorological Organization. So what happens is everyone who does this across the globe, it doesn't matter where you are, we release at the same time. That is in the afternoon and also at midnight hour. So make sure that at least within 12:30 and 1 o'clock it's released. So that is happening throughout the globe at the same time. That's the interesting part of it. So we are able to collect the all these weather parameters throughout around the globe.
Yeah, so we are part of a global process, even as you and I speak at the moment. As you can hear, it is quite loud, so we're going to step away a little bit so that you and I can continue with the conversation in an audible way. And, of course, I imagine amongst the questions that people have is that device you were showing us, how do you get it back? Can you get it back?
Yeah, so let me also tell you that equipment is quite expensive. So the entire process that we are doing here, it costs us close to 5,000 rand. Yes. And we do it twice a day. We're talking about 11 stations across the country. So it's quite a lot of money that goes up in the sky. Now, the question you are asking is, how do we retrieve it back? Well, the balloon, as I indicated, will burst at some point as it goes up, maybe 20 kilometers or more than 20 kilometers up. So when we release it here at Irene, it can fall somewhere, maybe in Mpumalanga. It's not like it will come back here. So, but we have put the notification that if you get this device, know that it's a South African weather, so you can bring it back to us. But we use it once. Let me put it that way. Right. We use it once because we don't even know where it's going to fall.
Yeah.
So as we release it here now, we cannot predict where it will fall. It all depends on the atmospheric conditions up there in the sky. The wind might be blowing east or it might be blowing west, so it can fall as far as possible from here.
Absolutely. So if you're watching from anywhere.
Meanwhile, in other news, Zimbabwe's gold reserve have surged in 2 years.
Zimbabwe's push to collect mining royalties in gold rather than cash is beginning to bolster confidence in the country's latest effort to reintroduce a local currency. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe has steadily increased its bullion holdings, supported by stronger global gold prices and rising local production. This has helped to support the ZiG, which has remained relatively stable against the US dollar over the past year.
I think it's a good start. So, you know, 1 year in or just about with the governor, I think this is definitely a good start. We need to continuously have those gold reserves audited by external auditors, and they need to continuously keep those gold reserves.
But despite this, the US dollar still dominates everyday transactions across much of the economy.
According to official statistics, the ZiG accounts for between 30 to 40% of transactions done through the national payment system. Now, that's the official channel. That number is quite lower in the informal market.
Analysts say the increase in gold reserves has yet to translate into tangible benefits for ordinary Zimbabweans, many of whom continue to rely on foreign currency for savings and trade.
It's quite remote at the moment for the general person to really feel the impact of the gold reserves on the market. But the build-up or the foundation for the currency to then gain its ground in the local market is what is currently prevalent, which I think is quite important for anchoring the currency and deepening its reach both locally and internationally.
Zimbabwe expects gold deliveries to reach a record 60 tons this year, a milestone authorities hope will strengthen reserves further and encourage wider adoption of the ZiG in the formal economy. Farai Makutuya, CGTN, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Sudan steps up plans to revive agriculture amid local-driven food crisis.
The impact of the conflict in Sudan has been felt across all sectors, triggering one of the world's largest hunger crises, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization. Sudan's vital agricultural heartland of El Gezira State suffered catastrophic damage in the first year of fighting, as armed groups looted farm machinery, destroyed irrigation infrastructure, and flooded agricultural lands.
Sudan,
Many agricultural projects were disrupted, impacting some of the country's agriculturally productive states. The looting of farmers' assets, including machinery and equipment, the destruction of agricultural projects, and the loss of crop stocks have all cast a long shadow over the agricultural sector, both rain-fed and irrigated.
It's been more than a year since the National Army recaptured much of Central Sudan from the RSF, pushing them out of El Gezira State and setting the stage for a slow recovery in the once thriving food basket region. The government is now seeking to inject fresh impetus into that initiative with the unveiling of a new ambitious plan to cultivate more than 20 million acres in the upcoming planting season. This is meant to ensure the nation does not go hungry as the three-year conflict takes its toll on food production and distribution systems.
The plan for the summer season covers 25 million acres, of which 2 million acres are irrigated and 23 million acres are rain-fed. We aim to cultivate approximately 14 million acres of maize, while millet will cover less than 2 million acres.
And the government is working closely with the Sudanese Agricultural Bank to realize this objective.
This season, we aim to finance 40% of the Ministry of Agriculture's extension plan. The ministry targets the cultivation of 25 million acres this summer, and the Agricultural Bank has prepared a plan to finance approximately 10 million acres.
Apart from boosting agricultural production, authorities say they are working to address the lingering challenge of limited storage facilities to cut down on substantial post-harvest losses in the vital sector. However, external factors, including the disruption of shipping routes like the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, are proving more challenging to address. David Mbidi, CGTN.
So in Africa-related news, Tanzania 6 oversees a shift from bank savings to investment products.
Pomp and ceremony in Dar es Salaam as another public investment bond enters the market. Among those attending is Charles Ligonja, a former teacher turned certified financial educator, investing in the $38 million bond issue. He says growing public interest in investment products reflects a financial mindset change he has spent years promoting.
I noticed many workers would receive their salaries, but within 10 or 15 days, they were already complaining that the money was finished. Then there were senior officers who retired with $38,000 to $40,000, but within 3 months, the benefits were gone. That made me start asking questions.
Companies offering investment products say demand for bonds has grown because more people now understand how they work and because investing has become easier through digital platforms.
People have realized these investments are more hassle-free. For example, with our bond, investors receive returns every 3 months. That has given people greater confidence and more certainty about the income they earn from their investments.
Figures from Tanzania Central Bank show household financial assets rose to nearly $11.3 billion at the end of last year, up from around $10.8 billion a year earlier. Treasury bond holdings increased by over 115% during the same period, while investments in collective investment schemes grew by more than 50%. For decades, many Tanzanians kept their savings in banks or simply at home. But a growing number of urban investors are now turning to bonds and other financial products offering higher returns. The shift is creating new opportunities for personal wealth creation while also deepening Tanzania's capital markets and expanding financial inclusion. Regulators say the expanding investment market could also help support entrepreneurship and job creation.
Bond issuance supports the National Economic Empowerment Policy because the funds raised are used to grow small and medium-sized businesses and entrepreneurship.
Industry players say misinformation and online fraud remain key challenges as more first-time investors enter the market. but they remain optimistic that stronger regulation and growing public awareness will continue driving investment uptake, especially among Tanzania's expanding middle class. Isaac Lukando, CGTN, Dar es Salaam.
The Africa Continental Free Trade Area had hailed outcomes from Baishara Africa Conference.
Ahead of the conclusion of the Biashara Africa Conference 2026, the Secretariat's Secretary General signed three memoranda of understanding that are aimed at deepening trade integration, strengthening financial inclusion, and enhancing partnerships across the continent.
We have to focus on investing in industrial development for the medium and the long term, so that we build our economies, and we have to invest in infrastructure. Some of the disbursements that the AfCFTA Adjustment Fund has already made are exactly for this purpose. We are also engaging our development partners, the DFIs, African Bank, AFDB, Africa 50, to ensure target specific sectors in country to enhance competitiveness.
And they specifically address issues such as trade integration, access to finance, and particularly for small, medium enterprises that trade across borders, as well as ensure partnerships and collaborations across the African continent amongst businesses and investors.
220 billion. In intra-African trade, you know, as a value. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? It means that things are happening, not fast enough, but we must look at those numbers as a signal of hope, understanding which value chains they are, and start to invest there for expansion.
But there are teething issues that small, medium enterprises, young innovators need addressed.
Selling in Togo here, we don't have many customers. But selling in another countries can make me have many customers. But the price that I will sell it in another country is different than the price that I will sell it here. So I think it's not benefit for me to sell it in another country.
At the same time, China's zero tariff policy for African exporters has been commended, with regional economic blocs challenge to boost local capacity for value addition and trade in order to boost Africa's exports to China.
SMEs need capital. They need capital without these requirements like Corato ETC. They need logistics.
I spoke to some of the policymakers, business leaders, innovators, entrepreneurs to get a feel of what they make of this year's conference.
For me, what is most instructive for Biashara 2026 is an example of leadership, an example of what can happen if the political will is there to make the change that Africa deserves for us to be able to implement a borderless trade in Africa.
And I think the biggest highlight for me has been being part of the ministerial roundtable discussion, where we had a number of ministers essentially listening to the private sector, including ABAN, trying to understand what are some of the challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis.
Regional trade and competition regulators have called for stronger collaboration in harmonizing competition laws in order to protect businesses, consumers, and regional markets as momentum builds towards the implementation of a free trade area for Africa. Zawadi Mdibo, CGTN, Lome, Togo.
And now for some news beyond African borders. Russia-China ties an unprecedentedly high level. Putin tells Xi Jinping in Belgium.
It's 3 p.m. here in the afternoon, and things have been moving swiftly since Chinese leader Xi Jinping welcomed his Russian counterpart at the Great Hall of the People. Vladimir Putin's arrival in Beijing coming just days after Donald Trump's state visit here. In the last hour, Xi and Putin have been taking part in a signing ceremony as they look to further cement a relationship that has become something of a diplomatic lifeline for Moscow during its war with Ukraine. The first document signed was a joint statement between the two countries on further strengthening comprehensive strategic coordination and deepening good neighborly and friendly cooperation. That was followed by 20 other documents signed on trade, technology, food exports, scientific research, among many others. Now, the two countries are also expected to issue a joint statement on advocating for a multipolar world and a new type of international relations. State media here have been suggesting that the quick succession of foreign visits from the likes of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin shows China's growing status on the world stage. Now, earlier, the two leaders exchanged their views on the bilateral relationship between the two countries.
This year marks the 30th anniversary of the establishment of partnership and strategic cooperation and the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty on Good Neighbors, Friendship and Cooperation.
Even against the background of unfavorable external factors, our cooperation and economic cooperation demonstrate good and high dynamics. The trade turnover has grown more than 30 times in a quarter of a century. It has been steadily exceeding the $200 billion mark for several years in a row. The locomotive of economic cooperation in Russian-Chinese cooperation in the energy sector.
For the view from Beijing, here's our China correspondent, Laura Bicker.
We saw the marching band, we heard the cannons fire, we saw the cheering children. Check, check, check. What we are seeing is an almost near mirror-like image of the visit that President Xi laid on for Donald Trump last week. Now, if you're watching from Washington, you might think, well, hang on a second, what was special about our visit? I think we'll have to see how the day unfolds. But we're also hearing that President Putin may even have tea in Chongnanhai, which is the secretive Communist Party headquarters, where Donald Trump got a tour, looked at the trees and looked at the roses last week. So I think it's interesting to compare and contrast. But you mentioned there, when it comes to Beijing, China is eager to portray itself and their president as the leader that the world is welcoming. And that is what you're seeing again today.
Yeah, and that's some of the language you've heard as well that's emerged so far. What's got your attention?
So I think the key thing for both sides in this is when it comes to those energy talks. I think there's a couple of things that drew my attention. The first was President Xi telling his counterpart that he wanted a ceasefire in the Middle East. He's calling for the two sides to end hostilities, and that by that means America and Israel and Iran. Now, when it comes to that call, it's quite interesting to call for the end of a war in the Middle East, but he's sitting across from a man who invaded Ukraine, who invaded Europe. So I think when it comes to calling for an end to one war but not mentioning the other, I think many world leaders will be looking at this and looking at Beijing and say, look, if you want some credibility, you have to bring up the war in Ukraine with your Russian counterpart. The second thing I noticed was the discussion of this Siberian 2 pipeline. Now, obviously, the war in Iran is squeezing China's supplies of oil and gas. So when it comes to energy, they may be looking towards Russia, towards their northern neighbor for more supplies. So that pipeline has been in discussion for years. Mr. Putin might see his chance and might believe his chance to get it through and get it signed is now.
I spoke with Klaus Sung earlier, who's an expert on Chinese politics and China's relations with the West and Russia from Mercator Institute for China Studies. He says the meeting between Putin and Xi will show massive political advantages for China.
So I think that many different interpretations, especially focus on economic and energy side. And I think these are important for sure, that for especially on the energy side, as we just hear and mentioned. But I think there's another angle here to stress on, especially that what Xi might gain from Putin's visit is that the image of all nation coming to the court, that reflecting Beijing's growing strategic depth, right? And it can seek stability on one side, on hand with the United States while enhancing its partnership with Russia, that all major power came to Beijing to seek favor or have request expectation on Beijing to step in different kind of issue. So I think that is a political image and gain for Beijing to expecting and will achieve from having hosting both Putin and Xi Putin and Trump in a close days in 1 week.
Yeah, the optics certainly do look like Beijing has a certain gravitational pull when it comes to geopolitics. For Putin's part, though, what will he be hoping to gain from this visit? He comes under very different circumstances with the Ukraine war dragging on.
So yeah, I think that Putin aims to consolidate the China-Russia alignment, right, and to make sure that it does not come as a surprise for the reapproachment or reconciliation between US and China when Beijing seek to building up the so-called strategic stability with Washington, right? And I think that also to gain greater support from China, especially when Ukraine gained its momentum in the battlefield. So China's support to Russia, to Moscow in a certain extent is more and more critical to continue, no matter it's continuing the war, or at least to even think about China as a potential way or possible solution to end the war that saves the base for Moscow.
And that right there brings us to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program brought to you by Peniambeko Janus, and thereafter other shows follow your way. From Indafa, happy Juju. It's goodbye.